When you walk into any large office building or like a school or a hospital, there is this implicit social contract.
Right.
You see those glowing red exit signs, and you see the fire extinguishers on the wall. And you just sort of assume that if something goes wrong, the systems are actually in place to keep you safe.
Yeah,
You
absolutely.
assume the door's actually open.
It's a foundational trust, really. I mean, we operate under the belief that the institution we are walking into prioritizes the physical safety of the people inside it over, almost anything else.
Right. But what if you found out management had actually padlocked the fire doors because they didn't want the alarm making noise during a board meeting?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that would be.
Right. And they just left the glowing signs up anyway to make it look like everything was fine.
Just for show.
Exactly. And that is the reality alleged in a pretty jarring statutory audit from April 25th, 2026. It's titled Institutional Silence, the NYPD's Policy of Concealment and Retaliation. It's authored by Eric Sanders.
It is a heavy document.
It really is. And that is our mission for this deep dive today. We are exploring the legal obligations of public employers regarding workplace safety, violence prevention, and whistleblower protections, using this specific audit as our roadmap.
And it is a roadmap that raises a deeply unsettling question. I mean, what happens when a massive public agency treats workplace danger not as a legal compliance issue, but as a political management problem?
Before we really get into the weeds of how an agency might do that, I do need to make something crystal clear for you listening. Our goal today is to objectively report on the claims, the allegations, and the legal analysis provided in this specific 2026 audit.
Right.
We are not taking any political sides here. We aren't endorsing any specific viewpoints of the author or the agency. We are simply serving as your guides to unpack the information and the legal frameworks presented in this source material so you can understand what the law actually demands.
Which is crucial, right? Because to spot an institutional failure, you first have to understand the legal baseline. And for public employers in New York, that baseline is not just some gentle suggestion. It is a rigid legal architecture, starting with New York labor law, section 27A.
So wait, I always thought federal OSHA laws just sort of covered everyone automatically. Why does New York need its own specific labor law for public employers?
That is a super common misconception, actually. Historically, federal OSHA didn't automatically cover state and local government
Oh,
employees.
really?
Yeah, it left this massive loophole where public servants could theoretically be subjected to incredibly unsafe working conditions without any real federal recourse. So New York closed that gap with Section 27A.
Okay, makes sense.
Yeah, it created the Public Employee Safety and Health Bureau, or PESH, and it explicitly requires public employers to provide occupational safety and health protections. I mean, you don't lose your right to a safe workplace just because your paycheck comes from a municipal government or a uniformed agency.
Right. So whether you are working in a precinct house, a municipal administrative office, or like a city warehouse, it is still a workplace. It's subject to strict workplace safety rules.
Exactly. And New York gets even more specific with Section 27B.
What does that one do?
Well, this law mandates that public employers must systematically evaluate the risks of workplace violence, and they actually have to implement functional prevention
So
programs.
they can't just ignore it.
No, notice to employees about these risks is a statutory duty. It is not a management choice. An employer cannot just look at, say, a severe assault that happened in a staff break room, decide it's a bad PR look for the department, and then sweep it under the rug.
Because if you bury the incident, you aren't actually evaluating the risk. And, if you aren't evaluating the risk, you obviously can't prevent it from happening to the next person who walks into that break room.
Precisely. And that leads directly to how staff can identify if their internal safety training is legally deficient.
Right, the training aspect.
Yeah, the audit brings up New York Labor Law Section 201 Der J. Now, this specifically deals with sexual harassment prevention, but it establishes a broader standard for training in general. The statute demands that training include real examples and actual risk evaluations.
Wait, so if an agency has a history of severe recurring incidents in their facilities, but their annual training module is just some sanitized, hypothetical, like, I don't know, a cartoon video about someone telling an inappropriate joke by the water cooler, that's a legal failure.
It is way worse than a failure. It is compliance theater.
Compliance theater. Wow.
Yeah, if the training bears no relationship to the actual hazards that employees are facing in that specific building, it outright violates the statutory mandate. And the audit alleges this is exactly what happened.
Just checking boxes.
Exactly. Management uses these sanitized scenarios to check a compliance box while completely ignoring real violent incidents happening within the facility.
And according to the audit, the way they hide those real violent incidents is through this, what they call a reclassification tactic. They literally just change the label on a paperwork.
That is the claim, yeah. So an employee is assaulted on the job, right? Instead of classifying that as a workplace violence incident, which would immediately trigger external reporting requirements and mandatory safety evaluations under Section 27B.
Right, the whole system kicks in.
Exactly. But instead of doing that, management quietly labels it a personnel matter.
Okay, let's unpack this. This sounds like a restaurant failing a health inspection, but just putting the F grade in a manager's desk drawer and calling it a paperwork issue.
That is a great analogy.
But legally, doesn't statutory compliance depend on the actual substance of an event, not whatever internal label management slaps on it?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you've hit on the core legal principle here. An employer's internal terminology cannot defeat external state law.
Okay, so the state law trumps their labels.
Absolutely. Statutory compliance turns entirely on the substance of the event, not the label management slaps on a file folder. If an incident affects working conditions, you know, if it impacts the physical safety of the staff, it is a workplace hazard.
Calling a fire a thermal personnel event doesn't exempt you from the legal requirement to evacuate the building.
Exactly.
But if the law is so incredibly clear about what must be reported and evaluated, I'm left wondering how institutions actually manage to keep these incidents so quiet for so long.
Well, the audit argues it happens through a profound institutional inversion. Leaders in these massive agencies often prioritize their organizational image, you know, their mayoral press coverage, and their overall public reputation way over the actual physical protection of their employees.
So optics become the primary objective.
100%.
And to maintain those optics, they use the illusion of confidentiality, which honestly feels really manipulative.
It is.
I mean, if you've ever worked in an office and received one of those vague HR emails saying, we're addressing a recent incident, you know exactly how this feels. It is framed as protecting privacy, but you're left wondering if the guy sitting next to you is dangerous and you just aren't allowed to know.
It is a deliberate blurring of lines. We really need to distinguish between legitimate privacy protections and the illegal suppression of safety information.
Okay, break that down for us.
Sure. So legitimate confidentiality protects the person. It means redacting a victim's name, protecting sensitive medical data, or, you know, keeping a witness safe from retaliation. Unlawful suppression protects the institution.
Nice.
Yeah, it's when management buries the fact that a hazard exists at all, just to avoid embarrassment or liability.
So what does this all mean? Because if I'm management, I'd argue I have to stay quiet to protect a victim's privacy. How can a civilian employee proactively identify when an employer is crossing the line from protecting a victim to just covering their own institutional reputation?
It comes down to pattern recognition. You really have to look at how the rule is applied. If confidentiality is consistently invoked only when an incident embarrasses leadership or exposes a failure in command, but it's totally ignored when the institution wants to leak something favorable to the press.
Oh, right.
Yeah, that is an illegal operational practice of suppression. It's using privacy as a pretext to keep the workforce in the dark. And employers do not have to broadcast a victim's personal details to comply with safety laws. There is a middle path.
What does the middle path look like?
They can and legally must issue anonymized risk alerts. They can update the facility's training to warn staff of specific hazards. You don't need to name the victim to say, hey, there have been recurring violent incidents in the north stairwell. Please adhere to these new security protocols.
And keeping people in the dark doesn't just hurt the employees in uniform. The audit points out that these facilities aren't closed ecosystems.
Right, not at all.
You have civilian employees, maintenance workers, vendors, contractors, witnesses, just regular members of the public stepping into these buildings every single day.
Exactly. By suppressing the information, the institution is reallocating the risk. Management gets to keep their clean public image, and the completely uninformed civilian stepping into the building carries all the physical danger.
That is genuinely chilling. But let's look at this from the perspective of an employee who actually notices this happening.
Okay.
You realize there is a hazard management is hiding. You start asking questions. According to the audit, this is where the system aggressively enforces its silence, right?
It does. Suppression requires making an example of anyone who threatens the narrative, The audit calls this the confidentiality pretext.
To confidentiality pretext.
Yeah. An employee asks a simple question like, hey, what happened with that violent incident last week? And suddenly, management shifts the entire focus. They aren't talking about the violence anymore.
What are they talking about?
They accuse the employee of unauthorized access or disloyalty for even asking.
Here's where it gets really interesting. So the employee who just asks about a hidden assault gets investigated faster than the actual assaulter.
What's fascinating here is that retaliation is not a side effect. It is a deliberate enforcement mechanism to maintain silence. It is a calculated maneuver to convert the employee from someone asserting their right to a safe workplace into someone accused of breaking internal rules.
Wow.
But this is exactly why whistleblower laws exist, specifically New York labor law, section 740.
So what does section 740 actually do to shield an employee in that specific scenario?
It is a powerful statutory shield. Section 740 protects staff from retaliatory action when they disclose, object to, or refuse to participate in employer conduct that they reasonably believe violates the law or presents a substantial and specific danger to public health or safety.
Reasonably believe. That phrasing feels very intentional. It implies you don't have to be, like, a legal expert to be protected.
It is the most important part of the statute, honestly. The employee does not have to be technically correct about every single complex legal nuance of the violation. A layperson's reasonable belief that the employer is hiding a danger or breaking the law is all that is required to trigger the protection.
Right, because you don't need a law degree to know that hiding a violent assault is wrong.
Exactly.
I always sort of thought retaliation just meant getting fired.
Yeah.
But if I'm reading this audit right, the tactics used by large agencies seem much, much quieter than that.
Oh, definitely. Firing someone is loud. It draws attention, which is the exact last thing an agency prioritizing optics wants to do. So the retaliation becomes administrative.
Like what?
It's a sudden transfer to a terrible shift so you can't pick up your kids.
Yeah.
It's the inexplicable loss of overtime opportunities. It's forcing the employee to endure a stressful, bad faith internal investigation over a minor typo on a report.
Over a typo?
Yeah. Or it's launching reputational smears meant to chill anyone else from speaking up. So if an employee is facing this exact situation, how do they navigate internal complaint processes without risking professional suicide? I mean, if asking a simple question gets you transferred to the night shift, you clearly can't just rely on good intentions.
You can't. You need a legally bulletproof strategy. The first step is recognizing that raising these safety concerns is a legally protected activity, even if management tries to brand it as insubordination.
Right.
But you have to shift how you operate. You need concrete tools. And the most effective tool is accessing official records, specifically OSHA and PEHH logs.
Let's break those down because they sound like a bureaucratic maze. What exactly are these logs?
Well, under federal and state rules, public employers are required to maintain specific injury and illness logs. The main ones are OSHA Form 300, which is the running log of all recordable work-related injuries.
Okay.
Then there's Form 300A, which is the annual summary of those incidents, and Form 301, which is the detailed incident report for each specific case.
So if an assault resulted in an injury, it legally has to be documented on that Form 300 log. Yes. And here is the absolute superpower for the employee. Under the law, employees or their authorized representatives have a federally and state-backed right to access those records. You can literally submit a request to see the logs for your facility.
Let's say you're an employee trying to securely track these compliance failures. You don't want to get hit with a bogus, improper access charge. How do you document this pattern securely and legally?
This raises an important question. The trap is trying to act like a private investigator. You know, you don't go snooping through confidential internal affairs files or digging through your boss's desk.
Right. Keep it strictly professional.
Exactly. You focus entirely on the employer's audit trails and chronologies. You formally and legally request the PEHH logs, and you document the exact date and time you made that legally protected request.
Oh, I see. You are building a paper trail of your legally protected actions to prove the sequence of events.
Precisely. You don't need to steal confidential files. You just need to document the process. How the employer responded to your legally protected requests. You focus on chronology. Like on Tuesday, I formally requested the OSHA 300 log under my statutory rights. On Thursday, I was suddenly written up for a minor dress code violation from 3 weeks ago.
That makes total sense. It is really hard for management to claim it's just a coincidence when the timeline is that tight.
Exactly. And you also combine that timeline with comparator evidence.
What's comparator evidence?
It's asking, who else accessed information without being punished? If a supervisor regularly looks up incident reports to gossip about coworkers, but you get disciplined for looking up a report to check for a physical safety hazard, that inconsistency proves the retaliation.
Wow, yeah.
You are basically tracking the disclosure gap, the stark difference between what the law requires them to share and what they actually tell the staff.
And you don't have to do this all alone either. The audit brings up New York Labor Law Section 27 Buck, which is all about workplace safety committees.
Yes. Section 27 requires employers to permit staff to form and administer joint labor management workplace safety committees. This is a legally protected way to build internal coalitions and demand accountability collaboratively.
I think people hear committee and they immediately think of a boring monthly meeting with stale donuts.
Right.
But legally, what is the mechanism that makes a safety committee so dangerous to an agency that is trying to hide things?
It changes the entire dynamic of liability. When you form a safety committee, you are no longer just one isolated, quote-unquote, disgruntled employee asking an annoying question.
You're an official group.
You become a statutory body. So if management tries to transfer or discipline a whole committee for asking about hazard evaluations, they aren't just punishing an individual anymore. They are violating collective labor laws.
Oh, the legal liability for the employer skyrockets.
It does. It shatters their narrative that it's just a personnel issue with one insubordinate worker. A joint labor management committee forces the issue out of the shadows and onto an official record. It forces visibility. And visibility is the one thing a system of concealment absolutely cannot survive.
That completely reframes how we should think about workplace safety. It's not just about assuming the fire extinguishers work. It is about knowing you actually have the right to check the inspection tags.
Exactly.
So, to summarize the core takeaway for you listening today, your physical safety at work, even in a massive government agency, is not at the whim of management's political optics. You have statutory rights.
Very strong ones.
Right. You have a right to training that reflects the real dangers in your specific building. You have a right to access official injury logs like Forms 300 and 300A. You have the right to form safety committees. And you have incredibly powerful whistleblower protections under laws like Section 740 that shield you from retaliation when you demand a safe environment.
And if we step back and look at the macro level here, the audit leaves us with a deeply unsettling final thought to ponder.
What's that?
Well, if a massive law enforcement agency, an institution whose entire public mandate, its very reason for existing, is safety and the rule of law, if they are willing to bend the law to hide physical dangers from their own staff inside their own walls, what does that mean for the trust the public places in them out on the streets?
That is a question that definitely sticks with you, just like finding out the exit signs are unplugged. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Stay curious, stay informed, and know your rights.